Good morning. Welcome back. You know, it's just such a time of strife. And I think that the more metta we can practice, the more stability we will find to be present with all of the suffering that is around the globe. It's so difficult, and yet this practice is so brilliant in the way it can help steady the heart and steady the mind. So I've been doing a lot of metta practice lately because I've found for myself that it's steadying. It is steadying. I need to reconnect over and over again with my intention to really care, to really care, and to stabilize myself. So I bring that in as a place to start. May we meet this moment fully. May we meet it as friends. Such an important teaching. So the last time I was here, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about this also, about this path of love, taking the path of love. And how do we do that? And we spoke at length about these three instructions from Pema Chodron. One, be fully present in the mind, the heart, the body, with courage and curiosity and openness and willingness, these definitions of mindfulness, to feel your heart. I was teaching for the first time in a long time, an in-person gathering a couple of weeks ago, and we were all talking about what is mindfulness really? How does it show up for you? And somebody said, you know, my intention now, how I am in relationship with mindfulness is to let love hold whatever arises. And I was so moved by that. Let love hold whatever arises. And sometimes that's not easy, but it is such a gorgeous intention. Is love available anywhere inside of us? Sometimes more, sometimes less. So this second instruction from Pema, feel your heart. Let love hold whatever arises. And the third instruction is to engage the next moment without an agenda, which always makes me smile because many of us are full of agenda, right? We have a plan. We've got stuff we're doing. We want things to go a certain way. I mean, we have a list. But this is pointing to a certain kind of faith. And in Buddhist practice, faith is more trust or confidence. The Pali word is sadha, S-A-D-D-H-A. And it means, literally translated, my understanding is it means to place the heart upon. So to trust, to have this faith, to go in this direction of cultivating awareness and kindness and wisdom. So to engage the next moment without an agenda requires some equanimity, right? It requires a trust, a perspective. So those are the three instructions that we went through in depth. Be fully present, feel your heart, engage the next moment without an agenda. And I think when we live like this, that is this true, full expression of mindfulness. The presence that's big enough to include whatever is in the heart, but it must be supported by strength and steadiness and courage and each other. We need the Sangha. We need our refuges and precepts because it leads to wise and skillful response. And this is a time that we need wise and skillful and steady, courageous response. And remembering Thich Nhat Hanh's definition of mindfulness, it is that which allows us to look deeply and see what's going on. It means seeing and knowing what's going on. And in order to do that, we need to be fully present. We need to feel the heart, and we need to have some equanimity. We need to have that sense of, let's see what happens next, because that leads to wise and skillful action. And you might be thinking, I've been thinking, given this war that is happening and the wars around the globe, well, what is wise and skillful action? What can I actually do? Little me. What do I literally do? And everybody has their own definition, way of being with this. And I'm not here to tell you what to do at all. But to be present, to cultivate this practice is an enormous gift to responding to violence in the world. Angeles Arian, who was an anthropologist in the Bay Area, some of you know, I see nods. She said, action absorbs anxiety. Action absorbs anxiety. And you know, when I first heard that, I thought, well, yeah, it depends on what kind of action we're talking about. And I am quite certain that she was talking about wholesome action. Of course, she was talking about how does it contribute to the good. But if you think about all kinds of actions, how it absorbs discomfort, the way we can react to something because we have anxiety, we have fear, we have anger, we have restlessness, we have fundamental discomfort. We are very committed to keeping ourselves comfortable as animals. It's too hot. It's too cold. It's too this. It's too that. We're continually taking some action to absorb our discomfort. But our practice asks us to be really wise and skillful about the actions we take, knowing that wholesome action that contributes to the good leads to that place of further supporting faith, confidence, trust, clarity, and balance. Because we know that our actions are actually rooted in goodness. So here's a poem. This is called mimesis. And it's a very interesting word, M-I-M-E-S-I-S. And it's written by Fadi Judah. And mimesis means mimicry or imitation, representation. Like an imitation in art of something that is in the world. And you'll get it in a second. Here's the poem. My daughter wouldn't hurt a spider that had nested between her bicycle handles. For 2 weeks, she waited until it left of its own accord. If you tear down the web, I said, it'll simply know this isn't a place to go home and you get to go biking. She said, that's how others become refugees, isn't it? I'll read that to you again. Mimesis. My daughter wouldn't hurt a spider that had nested between her bicycle handles. For 2 weeks, she waited until it left of its own accord. If you tear down the web, I said, it will simply know this isn't a place to call home and you'd get to go biking. She said, that's how others become refugees, isn't it? Such an apt poem for now. How is it that we take what isn't ours, sometimes violently, some not violently, but this is such a beautiful representation of the spider web, the home, it's in my way, and we just destroy it so we can do what we want to do. So in the context of millions of people becoming refugees out of Ukraine now, and millions of others supporting them, opening their homes, feeding them, risking their lives. When we stay aware that it is happening across the globe and we sit in this practice of clarity and create stability, we are, in a sense, supporting those who are refugees, who are supporting others. So you can know that coming to practice with others and we can talk about these things is of value. It really does matter. Because what it must be like, I can only imagine, to live in that kind of fear and anger and violence, rejection, confusion, trauma. And what it does for me is further motivates my desire to stabilize myself all the time, these deeper and deeper commitments to understand non-harming and live from that place. And knowing that how we spend money, how we vote, what we do really matters. And everybody is different. I'm not in any way saying think this, think that. This is an exploration and we wrestle with this together. This is part of what our Sangha is for, is wrestling together. So it's time to take our practice really seriously. This is where the rubber really meets the road. So we'll move into our meditation shortly, but I wonder, let me just make sure. Before we do that, I just want to bring in this very important teaching from the Buddha that I come back to over and over again that says, by protecting myself, I protect others. By protecting others, I protect myself. And this is a teaching that you can wrestle with, that you can really dissect and look at what this means. You can change the language by caring for ourselves, by caring for myself. I am caring for others. By caring for others, by extension, I am the recipient of this. We are the primary recipient of our actions and our goodwill. So we look at how this humanitarian crisis affects us both externally and internally. You know, the actions we can take externally. How can we make contribution? Food, housing, donations, activism, allyship, writing letters, friendship, even conversation. And then internally, the actions we take, attending to ourselves, committing to this practice of clarity and acting from goodness, not reactivity. Ajahn Chah, the teacher of Jack Kornfield, he says, peace within oneself is to be found in the same place as agitation and suffering. It's not found in a forest or on a hilltop, nor is it given by a teacher. Where you experience suffering, you can also find freedom from suffering. And this is what we're going to explore today. How do we let love hold whatever arises? How do we hold both the joys and the sorrows, the terror that we know is happening, yet each one of us might be quite safe in our own homes, wherever we are? And to not have the, not adopt the NIMBY, not in my backyard, way of being, to actually hold these people in our hearts. By protecting myself, I protect others. By protecting others, I protect myself. Kōbun Shinō Roshi was a Zen teacher in the 20th century. And he says, the more you sense the rareness and the value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility. We face such a big task, so naturally, such a person sits down for a while. So if the only thing you can do is sit down and quiet the mind, tend to your heart and body, that is a responsible thing to do. The more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility. We face such a big task. So naturally, such a person sits down for a while. So let's move into our meditation now. So please find a comfortable posture. And again, eyes closed or eyes open, whether you're seated or standing or reclining, or maybe even for today, you might choose walking meditation. Meeting yourself just where you are. Allowing and welcoming whatever is here to belong. sensing the touch points of the body connected to whatever you're connected to. And we'll use these intention phrases. May I be grounded in my body. Let's spend the next few breath cycles sensing into the body. May I be grounded in my body. And then drawing the awareness into the heart center. Wherever you feel your own heart center, this energy of the heart. May my heart become open, soft, and stable. May my heart become open, soft, and stable. And bringing the awareness to the mind. May my mind become clear and balanced. May my mind become clear and balanced. And sensing into the breath. In this moment, may I breathe with ease. In this moment, may I breathe with ease. Grounded in the body, the heart open, soft, and stable. The mind clear and balanced, breathing with ease. So as we settle in, finding that place where you can settle your awareness, whether it's in the body, the breath, your metta phrases, try to stay there. When the mind wanders, gently come back and begin again. If you're noticing any tightness, bring a little softening energy to that place, just as an invitation to release any amount. As the stillness rises, and the mind relaxes and the heart softens, see if you can notice if there's some comfort in that. The comfort of quiet, the place where everything settles and relaxes any amount. Let yourself be close to that comfort. And as the mind is still quieter, the stillness begins to expand inside the body. Just notice if there are areas that have released, or the heart has softened, any constriction or holding physically maybe is released a little bit. And from wherever you sense this ease or stillness, see if it can spread throughout the body, throughout the arms and legs and hands, full torso, up through the neck and to the head, filling the whole body with this stillness, this quiet, this breathing here. And from this relaxed mind, this open heart, and this steady, grounded body, we train in knowing what is here, this present moment awareness, and we remember what else is possible. We train in meeting both the sorrows and the joys. This is called Wage Peace from Judith Hill. Wage peace with your breath. Breathe in firemen and rubble. Breathe out whole buildings and flocks of red-winged blackbirds. Breathe in terrorists and breathe out sleeping children and freshly mown fields. Breathe in confusion, breathe out maple trees. Breathe in the fallen and breathe out lifelong friendships intact. Wage peace with your listening, hearing sirens, pray loud. Remember your tools, flower seeds, clothespins, clean rivers. Make soup, play music, memorize the words for thank you in three languages. Learn to knit and make a hat. Think of chaos as dancing raspberries. Imagine grief as the outbreath of beauty or the gesture of fish. Swim for the other side. Wage peace. Never has the world seemed so fresh and precious. Have a cup of tea and rejoice. Act as if armistice has already arrived. Celebrate today. Let's take 5 minutes. Let's come back at 10 after the hour. Isn't that bell beautiful? I love it. So as we all arrive back, you know, as we, Carlita and I, incorporate the ritual of the bell, more and more to really let that be a piece of that which brings you back all the time. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh used that regularly as the mindfulness bell, that it would happen at random times. But when you hear that bell, it can represent so much. The pause, the metta, the reminder to come back, to begin again. So have a bell in your life. If you can have a bell in your life somewhere, do that. It's just a beautiful practice. So how do we let love hold whatever arises? That's the title of today's talk. Let love hold whatever arises. There's a famous story about Suzuki Roshi, the founder of Zen Center, where one of his students said to him, "Roshi, there's so much to learn here. You've been doing this for so long. What should I really learn? What is the most important thing?" And he said, "To find out what is the most important thing." Isn't that so Zen? Like, I'm not going to give you the answer. You have to wrestle with this. What is the most important thing? Is to find out what is the most important thing. And it's within that, in the finding out, in the wrestling, in the considering a koan, something that just twists the mind around, that we actually can come up with a direction. Or maybe we don't come up with an exact answer, but it's in the wrestling where practice shows up that gives us the courage and the faith and the trust and the confidence to do what Jason's talking about. I don't really know what the right thing to do is, but I'm going to stay present with the conundrum. So I want to come back to some very basic teachings today. And the reason the foundational teachings that we're given from the Buddha are foundational is because they are, because they're timeless, because they work, because we can keep coming back to them. And it isn't necessary, in my view and in my own practice, to keep going after more and more different kinds of teachings. I think it's fascinating. It's a wonderful scholarly intellectual pursuit to keep learning more. But you know, our basic teachings can take us so far. And I find that in times of difficulty, when I come back to the basics, is where I feel the most steady, where I'm reminded, where I become more grounded. So here's some basic teachings that we know that we can come back to that apply today. Hatred never ceases by hatred. By love alone is it healed. And we know this, right? This comes not only from the Buddha, but from Gandhi, from Martin Luther King, over and over again. We can't solve hate with hate. We have to disentangle from it. And our metta practice, the Dalai Lama says, is a practice of internal disarmament. Internal disarmament. This is how we uproot hatred. The Buddha goes on to say, greed and hatred and ignorance are the cause of suffering. Generosity, love, and wisdom bring happiness. Now, these all sound really obvious, but it's true. We need to turn them into practices. Greed, hatred, and ignorance are the causes of suffering. But the cause of happiness, generosity, love, and the wisdom that arises through those practices. The power of the mind. Mind is the forerunner, right? This is right out in front. Speak and act with a pure mind, and happiness will follow. That comes from the Dhammapada. Speak and act with an unkind mind, and unhappiness will follow. You can test that out all the time, and it comes true. Speak and act out of kindness, and happiness and kindness will follow. Plant seeds of goodness, and goodness will grow. It's really true. The truth of impermanence, the truth of dukkha, suffering, the not quite rightness of this and that, how we experience friction, the truth of anatta or not self or interbeing. These are all things that are true. Everything is in the process of change. Living a life is inherently difficult, and everything is connected to everything else. If you plant a pear seed, you won't get an apple tree, right? You plant a pear seed, you get a pear tree. We start seeing what things lead to the next things. So it's important to come back to these basic teachings that are so far-reaching. They're true. So let's talk about the Four Noble Truths. Let's just go back to this for today. And I bring this up, I just want to pause here, because I do find that when I am caught struggling or afraid in a difficult place, when I come back in a meditation to even reciting the Four Noble Truths or reciting the refuges or recommitting to ethical practices through the precepts, I feel better. It grounds me. So I want to talk about this today. And my hunch is that most of you know all of these things, and we need to re-know them. We need to come back over and over again to re-know them. So these Four Noble Truths, this is the teaching the Buddha gave in his seminal teaching after his awakening of sitting under the Bodhi tree and watching his mind until he figured it out, until he understood the workings of the mind. That life includes challenge. And sometimes the First Noble Truth is said, life is suffering. You know, you can think about it like that, but I think it is more that it includes difficulty, because life also includes beauty and joy and all kinds of wonderful things. And that the challenges, the stress, the difficulties that are inherent in a life, nobody's exempt. Not one of us is exempt from this. So to even think, I can live a life, you know, that any kind of difficulty that arises is somehow a personal affront or somehow wrong, we can disabuse ourselves of that notion. It's just normal. This is just what it means, that difficulty happens, and that there's a cause of the suffering. Greed, ill will, confusion, graspiness, insisting that things be a certain way. That is when the difficulty becomes the suffering, when we add the graspiness, the friction to it. Sylvia says, suffering is the imperative in the mind, that things be other than what they are. Suffering is the imperative in the mind that things be different. Well, we might want them to be different when they're difficult. Of course we do. But we don't have to make something more difficult. So difficulty happens and we tend to make it worse. That's the suffering. Another way, I think it was Shinzen Young, who's an LA teacher. I think this is attributed to him. Pain plus resistance equals suffering. Pain plus resistance equals suffering. Well, we don't want to hurt. Of course we don't want to hurt. But the more we can normalize it, the more we can work with whatever is here, it's not as bad. We don't have to make it worse. And the third noble truth, there is an end to suffering. And we talked about this earlier, these moments when the mind subsides and peace is possible. When we let go of the imperative and we say, all right, this is what is happening. It's a quality of acceptance and surrender. And I don't mean resignation. I don't mean white flag surrender. I mean a profound, it's like this. My husband said to me a while ago, we were having an ongoing issue with one of our family members. There was just conflict all the time. And years of conflict. And lots of trying to figure it out. And I know I'm not alone in this. We all have, can probably relate to some relationships are like that. And just kept trying, if I do this, how about this and that? And one day my husband said to me, you know what the problem is here, Heidi? You're fighting the truth. This is how it is. And this is spoken from a non-meditator, non-Buddhist. You know, you don't have to be involved in this practice to have the clarity to say, you're fighting the truth. We just need to accept what's happening here. And I'll never forget that moment, exactly where we were in the house. And he said, the problem here is you're fighting the truth. And it was in that moment, the third noble truth arose, where I could say, it's not what I wanted, but it's what I've got. And there was this subsiding of my mind. I could say, okay, that's true. Now we can go forward. And the fourth noble truth is there is a path to the end of suffering, the noble eightfold path. And I think also the rest of our practices, because in the eightfold path, there are the Brahmaviharas and all of these heart practices, the factors of awakening goes on and on. So all of the practices that we use help us manage the truth of suffering, the truth of how we make it worse, the truth that we don't have to because we have practices that help us. So a very simple way of saying the Four Noble Truths that comes from Tony Bernhardt, another Bay Area teacher, difficulty happens. We tend to make it worse. We don't have to. And here's how. Isn't that beautiful? That's it. We don't need complex language around this. So that's the basics, right? These four noble truths open up into everything else. The four foundations of mindfulness. The four foundations of mindfulness are mindfulness of the body and the breath. The second foundation is mindfulness of what's called Vedana, the feeling tone, the awareness of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. The third foundation, mindfulness of the mind, emotions, and thoughts. And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness, awareness of basically everything else. And this is where the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path come in and the Brahmaviharas. But I want to talk for a little bit today about this second foundation, because it is so informative, it is so powerful in how we experience our lives. And this is the foundation of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. What is it like? And what, it's very easy to understand, oh, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, this is somewhere in the middle. And understanding versus experiencing is very different. One is conceptual, One is how it actually plays out in one's life. So we easily understand pleasant, unpleasant. So if you imagine that there's this continuum line that we all live on and we all experience, and over here is the most glorious, pleasant you could imagine. And over here is the most despairing, the most difficult experience. But we don't usually live in extremes. We're here, somewhere in the center. And sometimes it's thought of as the neutral zone. It's this place where we pretty much operate out of habit, habitual reactivity, habitual responsiveness, or maybe we just, it's sort of a, like, it's okay. You know, it's a place that we operate on default, where we're less aware of the ways that pleasant, unpleasant influence our experience. So many of our responses are conditioned out of habit, out of our conditioning, our genetics, where we've been raised in the family, in the community, in our education. And so, of course, we have conditioning filters through which we see and experience the world. And the thing that's so interesting about pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is that the experience of it happens in a pre-verbal place. You don't walk into a room and have the conscious thought, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, this is somewhere in the middle. We don't do that, but we know it intuitively. You had that experience, you walk into a room and you go, oh, I really want to be here. This is sweet. Or you walk in and you go, ooh, you can feel the energy. And it depends on how our conditioning is. What is pleasant to one person might not be to another. Anais Nin famously said, we don't see the world as it is. We see it as we are. We don't see the world as it is. We see it as we are. And we can't help it. This is perfectly normal. But through mindfulness, we start seeing our conditioning and the habitual patterns of our minds and our experiences. And oftentimes, when we experience something pleasant, we want more of it. Because it's totally natural. Oh, this is really nice. I want it to be like this. I want more of it. When it's unpleasant, we push it away. Ew, I don't want to do that. Of course we do that. You know, this is back to this thing of keeping ourselves comfortable all the time. And we do it oftentimes unconsciously. It's a default habitual way of being. So here's an example of how fear, unpleasant, might show up. This is a poem from Nikki Giovanni called Allowables. I killed a spider, not a murderous brown recluse, nor even a black widow. And if the truth were told, this was only a small sort of papery spider who should have run when I picked up the book, but she didn't, and she scared me, and I smashed her. I don't think I'm allowed to kill something because I'm frightened. So this is an example, right, of what happens with unchecked fear, startle even, that we just go from here to here so quickly. It's a spider. I better kill it. It might hurt me because we feel threatened. It's a spider. What's it doing? Oh, it's crawling across the page. I don't want it on my desk. I think I'll scoop it up and take it outside. But it takes awareness to do that, right? It takes training. It takes undoing the conditioning that if there's a spider, it equals harm. Not necessarily. So this is a really important piece of how do we notice the pleasant, the unpleasant, the neutral. And oftentimes that neutral place, just want to backtrack a little bit, that neutral place is a lack of engagement. Oftentimes it can be thought of as just being in default mode, sort of numbed out, not paying attention, spacey, not engaged. But I challenge you to take up a practice of watching neutral. See if anything is actually neutral. My sense is there's not. And if you think of, I think of neutral, think of a car, how the gears are disengaged when it's in neutral, but they're engaged when it's not. So we want to keep an engaged mind, an engaged presence. This is important. So we don't go through our lives on autopilot. So ultimately, what we're doing here is transforming habitual reactivity into habitual responsiveness by being so present with what is happening that we actually are modulating in a wise, skillful way. And this doesn't mean holding our attention so tightly that we feel like, that we're under a microscope. Not that at all. But in this training, what happens is we become more and more aware all the time. And we see that depending on what is present, it leads to acceptance or rejection, pushing and pulling all the time. Just because something is unpleasant doesn't mean it's wrong. Unpleasant is just unpleasant. We don't have to apply a value judgment to it. Pleasant is just pleasant. It doesn't mean it's better. It's just what it is. But it is important to notice our default responses because ultimately we are transforming reactivity into responsiveness. And you might remember this very famous quote from Viktor Frankl, who was an important activist and thinker of the last century, Holocaust survivor. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space, lies our freedom and power to choose. In our response lies our growth and freedom. This is going from the second noble truth to the third noble truth. The space is noble truth 2.5. That's what I think about this. Between stimulus, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and response, right here, can we pause and take a breath? There is a space. This is where the mindfulness comes in. This is where we choose. How do I want to be? That is powerful. That is a very powerful place. And it's not easy because the brain is wired with a negativity bias. It is looking out for danger. It is looking out to keep us safe all the time. Because neurons that fire together wire together. You may be familiar with that adage. The more we see what's wrong, the neural pathways wire together to see what's wrong. The more we see what's good, those neural pathways wire together. And we incline the mind, we train the mind in that way. The Buddha said, that which one frequently thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. Whatever you think about a lot, you're training the mind to think about a lot. So what do you want to think about? What do you want to notice? It doesn't mean put your head in the sand and don't notice what isn't okay. But you do have a choice about what you marinate in. You know, Sylvia said one time, the mind is like tofu. It absorbs the flavor of whatever it's marinating in. So choose your marinade carefully, right? You want to marinate in sourness? Okay, or in sweetness. It doesn't mean don't know sour, don't know sweet, but make a choice. I have so much more I want to bring in, and I'm not going to have enough time to do it. I want to bring you something that somebody in another sangha brought to my attention that I think is really beautiful. And this comes back to how do we meet both joy and sorrow? It's such hard work, right? It is such hard work because our hearts break. Our hearts break with joy and our hearts break with sorrow. And we train in this awareness so we can meet both. We can't always hold both, but we can meet both. So this comes from a writer. Her name is Marie Andrew, and she's a writer and an artist who's based in New York City. And this comes from her work called self-practice. I just want to read this to you. I'm washing my face before bed while a country is on fire. It feels dumb to wash my face and dumb not to. It's never been this way, and it's always been this way. Someone has always clinked a cocktail glass in one hemisphere as someone loses a home in another, while someone falls in love in the same apartment building where someone grieves. The fact that suffering, mundanity, and beauty coincide is unbearable and unremarkable. I consider whether it's foolish to want to have children at times such as these, and I consider that it's always been times such as these, and I consider that it's never been worse, then in some ways never been better. Shouldn't my hypothetical future child have their chance to smell honeysuckle and taste berries? These thoughts roll around my head like marbles that were tossed on a smooth surface. How is a person supposed to do ordinary things like face wash or big things like fall in love when a quick phone scroll is both advertising discounted designer socks and informing me that 12 million acres have been burned? 12 million. I despair with an exhale. Then I refuse to despair with an inhale. Despair is a tool to control us, it says. I scroll some more. A new baby, a new album, a flower, firefighters. A threatened world holds so much. I must choose between despair and energy. I choose the latter, says Keats. What does it look like to state in the midst of smoke? I choose energy. For starters, I choose to finish washing my face. Then I choose to look. Not away, but toward. I choose to trust, first in goodness, then in people I know, then in people I'll never meet, always in myself. I choose to eat less meat and dairy, even though, yes, there are zillions of other ways to help the planet, but that should never stop me from doing one thing. And I care about cows and koalas and my cat and the pigeons she watches. I choose to do the things that I may think are too insignificant to matter because sometimes protesting is an act of grieving and small choices towards energy keep me from despair. I choose to enjoy. I choose a new record. I choose to keep a $5 bill in my pocket for someone who may need it. I choose to text a friend, I'm sending lots of love. And I choose to buy from Aboriginal-owned businesses. And I choose to show up at a birthday party because grief and celebration often happen in the same night. So this is an example of by protecting myself, I protect others. By protecting others, I protect myself. Plant seeds of goodness and well-being will grow.